vegetarian, then paleo. You stopped restricting. You're trying to love yourself more, but nothing seems to be working fully. And you might feel hopeless about ever feeling good in your body. And every time you fail, you trust yourself less. As the larger world feels increasingly in peril, caring about how you feel in your body may feel frivolous and even more hopeless. We are at a time when our individual and collective stories about what to do for our bodies, health, and the world are crumbling. Because these stories we have, they aren't working for how our bodies or our world actually works. And I believe centering our bodies, all bodies, not just thin, white, or quote, good bodies, and what all of our bodies need to thrive will help orient us in a better direction. There's no one-size-fits-all diet, exercise, or way to biohack. Good health is much less about willpower or discipline and more a complex interweb of our societal structures, food choices, emotional history, environmental exposures, and privilege. There is a great loss of certainty and safety when we initially have to face what is real versus the half-truths we've been fed. But the loss of these stories creates an opening. If this opening is pursued with curiosity and discernment, we can discover our awe-inspiring ability to create and embody a new body story for our physical and political bodies and the earth. I'm Ali Shapiro, and I host the Insatiable podcast, so we engage in the type of conversations that will lead us to radically new body stories for ourselves, each other, and the earth. To do that, we discuss a more truthful approach to freedom from cravings, emotional eating, binging, and being all or nothing. We explore the hidden aspects of fighting our food, our weight, and our bodies, and dive deep into nutrition and behavioral change science and true whole health. But fair warning, this is not your parents' healthcare or the conspiratorial crazy of the wellness world. This is a big rebel gathering to those who want to hold nuance, context, and complexity in order to lead the way to a healthier future for all, because our lust for life is truly insatiable. Hey everybody, Ali here. I'm coming to you with a special Insatiable episode today because my friend, colleague, and someone whose work I deeply admire, Laura McGowan, has a new book out called Push Off From Here. Laura has also been on the pod before talking about her relationship to sugar in season 11, Sugar Rehab, and it's one of our most popular episodes. So I know our community digs her work. And there's a lot of overlap because Laura has invited me several times to teach in her The Luckiest Club sobriety group, because she, like many of those in The Luckiest Club, and what I notice with my own clients, is that a lot of people who struggle with alcohol, food was actually their original coping mechanism. And that was the case with Laura, and she shares about this in her new book. So a lot of people, alcohol eventually becomes the bigger, more consequential issue they need to work through first. But then when they give up alcohol, food becomes the thing. It becomes the thing or it returns. And I really wanted to have her on the podcast because her book is a book, yes, about sobriety, but it's most deeply a book about change. And it's about change of things that we want to stop, right? The way that I view it is new habits are things that we want to start and they rest on control. Whereas bad habits are, as Laura articulates and discusses in her book, are places where we have to be willing to be led. And as I read this book, I can just tell you there's an honesty, a truth that she brings to the page that so many times in this book, I said to myself, she nailed it. Her writing and insights are trustworthy. And again, they just speak to this deeper level of conversation we need to be having around change, with alcohol being included. But in this conversation, we center food and body image struggles. And of course, the overlap with alcohol in terms of root causes, how both the fantasy of alcohol and thinness, we have to be willing to let those go. The connections between wanting to be saved, desired, and chosen, fueling both alcohol and body image issues. And we discuss Laura's view of sobriety as an invitation into a bigger yes, which is what I view our body battles are. And we discussed the pushback around both of those suggestions. And this was also a great discussion around the connection between eating disorders, alcohol use disorder, and sensitive, empathetic, and perceptive people, thanks to a great question by a listener. So settle in, enjoy this conversation, and I highly suggest grabbing a copy of Laura's new book, Push Off From Here, 9 Essential Truths to Get You Through Sobriety and Everything Else. You can order it at lauramcgowan.com/books, and she gives you lots of choices of where to order it from, or wherever you buy your favorite books. All right, enjoy the episode. And if you get something from this, share it with someone who also could get something from it. Take care and enjoy. Welcome back to Insatiable, Laura. I am so excited to discuss your new book, Push Off From Here.
Hey, Allie. I'm so happy to be back with you.
Yeah. So I love the book. What strikes me is just the soul that you write. There's a lot of books out there. You know, I have a background in change. That's what my master's degree is. And to me, this is really a book about change through the lens of sobriety. But there's something about when you've actually been in it yourself, it just makes you such a trustworthy, like, soulful guide. And so I know you're a great writer, but it's also because of who you are. So I just want to tell everyone, this is like a book you can trust.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot. Yeah. I never really trust advice from people who haven't been through it. So that's good to hear.
Yeah. I think we're in a new era. I feel like 30, 40 years ago, it was like the person on the pulpit, right? Who was, you know, the expert because they've studied in some obscure, when you have to study and get like doctorates or masters, it's like you study this like one specific thing, but change is so holistic.
Yeah.
So I love that. Okay. So again, this is a book about change and you bring it through the lens of sobriety. But with my background in change, I know that starting new habits and stopping quote unquote bad habits usually require different approaches. And starting new habits is often more about control, what we want to accomplish. And in my experience, both personally and professionally in creating truce with food, which is really a change process about stopping quote unquote bad habits.
Yeah.
Stopping bad habits is more about what you say in the book, willing to be led. And I just love this because I was like, she nailed it. That's what it is. So can you please tell us more about what you mean about willing to be led when we really want transformational change?
It's such a good question. I love that you zeroed in on that. So right before I got on to talk to you, I received a message, as I do very often, from someone on Instagram. She was talking about her drinking, but it could be about anything.
Yeah.
She said, I hate drinking and I can't seem to stop. When I do, I feel better, but I start right back up again. What is happening? And I receive variations on this message all the time. And my response is different today than it would have been maybe 8 years ago when I was trying to get sober. And it's just, this is addiction. And this is what happens. It's not your fault. This is addiction. And she said, well, what do I do first? And I said, find a group, find other people who have been there. That is square one. And that speaks directly to being willing to be led. Because when it comes to change of any kind, especially this like sort of profound change of quitting bad habits, quote unquote, it is about being led. It's about humbling yourself to be availed to help, which is very hard for me and a lot of people. And also joining into a community of people who are going through what you're going through, have already been there, are perhaps further down the line, relinquishing this ever-present idea of the self as the master. And the control that we think we are supposed to have over everything. And we went back and forth, her and I went back and forth, and she's like, you know, I've never thought of it as addiction. It's so obvious that it is, but I just feel like I should be able to fix it. I'm like, yep, everyone feels that way. You cannot do it alone. And I hate that. I hated that. And it's just true.
I love that. different clients in my own truth certification this week, we've been talking about the concept of self-help. And it's like, most of us, the problem is we're trying to do everything ourselves.
Yep.
And it's like, no, this is why it doesn't work. You have to be in relationship. You have to have a witness. Yes. You have to have someone who knows what it's like. And so I love that. That's step one. And I love that you were making it so practical, because in my mind, it was, and again, this is kind of jumping later in the book where you talk about sobriety being an invitation, mm-hmm. but it's like, what is life asking of you that you need to address, right? That may not be what you've chosen in terms of your personal development, but what is life asking of you? So I love that you make it practical, because I immediately went to like this abstract spiritual.
Well, it is that too, of course, you know, it is that too. That can leave you without a step or two to take. And it's like, the step is open your mouth to another person, start telling the truth to another person. It's funny. I was texting with a really good friend yesterday, and she was asking about therapy. Did you find a good therapist? Cause I've been looking for a new one. And I said, no, I kind of like abandoned my search for a while. And she said, I want to address these certain things, but I want someone who is more action oriented. I want them to just like tell me tools and tips that I can take. And I'm like, well, that's not really therapy. That's not the therapeutic model, right? We all want that. We all want the answer. But what you said about being in relationship, it's like you have to enter this space where being led is not just about someone giving you the answers. It's you exploring with another person. You have to participate, is what I'm saying. She said, what about a podcast? I'm like, nope, not going to cut it. Podcasts are great tools. Books are great tools. But in my experience, she told me the things that she wants to work on, and they're big, and they take time, and they take participation, and they take relationship. And in that relationship, there is absolutely an element of humbling yourself to being led, meaning you don't have the answers and you're willing to go to participate in this process of working with someone to find them and to explore them and to create them and to learn about them. So I just want to say, it's not about buying the right book that's going to teach you or listening to the right podcast that's going to teach you. It's about entering a participatory process of being led, which is very different than just finding answers.
I love that. That's why I love that your book at the end of each 9 truths has questions. And I'm like, this is why I trust this book, because the obstacle and the path is self-trust. And so if someone else is giving you the answers, it's like, ah. And plus, a lot of us know, quote unquote, what we should do, but we don't do it because we have to come to those conclusions ourselves. Like,
it's experiential.
Yeah. So this book contains 9 truths, or as I think of them now, how to change when you're willing to be led.
I love that.
And reading this with my background, I was like, these could easily be applied to battling food in our bodies. Mm. And a lot of people I know who are in both of our communities, or people who I know who I've worked with who have gotten sober, they've often said that food has been their first thing, and was the case with you. And I love how I want to talk about the food and body stuff, but also the alcohol and the overlap of what you call in your book, the animating pain. And I just love that word, animating pain. I mean, that's like visceral. Mm. And so we'll go through each of the truths. And I have to say, as I read them initially, because you do kind of an intro, right? Defining your terms. I was like, I love the paradox within them, which is where truth exists. And then you go on to mention, it's like, they're paradoxical, which is, you said, the true nature of life. And I just love them. So we'll pair some of them together when we talk about them today.
Okay.
So the first one you said is, it's not your fault and it is your responsibility, which I just love that paradox. And you shared in your book that your first, well, I'm going to call it a coping strategy versus bad habit, was binging at 5 years old. And then your binging that led to weight gain is eventually what first got you into therapy when you were back. So what root causes have overlapped with your relationship to alcohol and eating? And I'm curious how you have found them to be different.
Yeah, the root causes I can see for both alcohol and food much earlier was feeling out of control of my environment and not having any way to, any healthy, functional way to deal with that stress. So feeling insecure at home, feeling not just insecure, I was in danger at home. I was not seen. There were a lot of big adult things happening, divorces and addiction and mental illness, but I didn't have a name for them, those things at all. You know, nobody talked about any of that. And my primary reaction to that was to blame myself. And that feels like that's a really overwhelming, scary feeling for a kid, for an adult, as to this is all my fault. And so what am I going to do with that? It's too much to cope with. There's too much shame. There's too much anxiety. There's too much self-hatred. There's too much all of these things. And so what am I going to do? Well, I figured out food could ease that pain and numb me out, all of those things, make me, you know, ground me in my body when I would dissociate. So that was the early thing. And then it was also the thing that alcohol helped me do too, was to not feel the chaos, the anxiety. The funny thing about alcohol is, for me, it was I need to sort of shapeshift myself into whatever I need to feel and be at the time to be okay. And so it's like this effort to gain more control, but you get out of control. The manifestation of it is like getting drunk and getting unconscious and like getting out of control. And the same thing is with food. I wanted more control of how I felt, so I would binge, and then my body felt out of control. The binging itself fell out of control. So it starts this shame cycle, right?
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah. And I love what you're describing. It's like the original feeling out of control was like, I can't be trusted. This is my fault. Shame, which most kids, we take on our environment just developmentally. And then when there's dysfunction, right? It's like, so it sows these seeds of doubt. And then the addiction or the food, it's like, oh, then this confirms the story I have about myself, right? And it just adds to the pain, but it's not really the root of the pain, but then it becomes part of it. So I don't want to say it's not real, because it is very real part of the pain, but it's like the genesis was something different.
Yeah, it's so true. The root cause for me, I can see now, was just so much. I just wanted to be seen and heard and appreciated and loved. It was just early attachment stuff that was not met. And I went about finding that or medicating the lack of that in every way I could.
Yeah. This reminds me of, I was listening to Dr. Becky, who I really like. She's I don't know if you've heard of her, but she was on Glennon Doyle's We Can Do Hard Things podcast. And I was like walking in the woods and she was talking about how kids were basically all feelings, all emotions when we're young. And I'm paraphrasing here, but she was basically like, if kids' feelings aren't validated, they don't feel real. So when you're saying, I want to be seen and heard, it's like, that is a primal need for children. And if you don't get that, it creates all these kind of like, so when you're saying I was shape-shifting, right, with alcohol, or it makes sense, right? It's like, this all makes complete sense when you see that stuff. But it's like, when she said that, I like got emotional and just like started crying. I'm like, it's so true. It seems. And again, even if you've had, we all grew up in this different era, you know, you and I grew up like we're Gen X, but it's like, I had wonderful parents, but it's like, if I remember complaining one time and they're like, you can call Child and Youth Services. They're, you know, here's the number. Like it wasn't like,
classic of that era. Right.
And it was like, okay. So my internal dialogue is always like, it's not that bad. Just like suck it up, you know, it's such a thing that we overlook. So and you talking about wanting to be seen and heard, this is, in Truth with Food, we work on kind of cultivating that emotional safety. It can be defined lots of ways, but in Truth with Food, we mean like not abandoning ourselves, like really liking ourselves, our choices. But first we have to know what our needs are and being seen and heard. And I want to pull this passage from your book, because I think this is such a visceral, soulful way to explain what blocks us from a deep sense of emotional safety. So to give some readers some context, this is the part in the book where you talk about this, your debt, adding up your debt from student loans to credit cards to parking tickets. And you say it's about $100,000. And you write how you felt so small, like a little kid. And then you wrote, looking at my reflection, I realized I wanted to see myself as a child, because kids have the right to be taken care of. Kids aren't expected to be able to pay bills, balance checkbooks, stay on top of things like licenses and registrations and inspections. Kids didn't have to find their way out of $100,000 in debt. Kids are supposed to be somewhat helpless. But I wasn't actually helpless, was I? I was in a really shitty spot, yes, but I wasn't helpless. So why did I want to be? It hit me like an anvil to the chest. I was waiting for someone to save me. Mm-hmm. And what struck me here was you wanted to be saved. And then you later shared on in the book how your disordered eating from age 17 to 35 was about wanting to be desired. Mm-hmm. And it just made me think of how the cultural waters we swim in, from religion to Disney to capitalism, drains us, many of us, especially women, to have this unconscious desire to be saved, which is a safety illusion. And then we're taught that how you're saved is by being desired versus having desires. You know,
yes.
Or to use like a food metaphor, but concretely, you need to override your hunger versus embracing your appetite. So I'm curious where you wanted to be desired and how did you apply it's not your fault and it is your responsibility to work through that need to be desired? And what, if any, effect did it have on your relationship with food?
Oh my God. Okay. Let's take these one at a time. Yeah. first question, part 1A. What
did you want to be desired by clients, by men, by readers?
Yes.
Yes. Was it all of it?
it was men were the biggest desire. Men, anyone from my dad to boys I liked when I was young to men later on in life, of every variety, bosses. It was largely a need to be desired, a longing to be desired by men, because as you said, I thought that would make me safe. That was my worth. That was my okayness. Was if I was desired, and not just desired, but like the chosen one.
Yes. Yes. Disney is great at making us think that's the thing.
Right? Yep. Yes. So I thought with the money, and I was sober then. I was like 2 years sober. So that was ouch. I just had this idea that this nameless, faceless thing was going to save me. And it wasn't, it was a male thing, but that it was going to save me and fix the money, but also fix everything else. It's embarrassing to admit, but that's just what it was.
But I think most of us might not realize that, but I realized that even with part of like reversing all my health stuff and being like, how did I not know about this? But it was like this dark night of the soul to me that Western medicine had saved my life, but then it was like, it had nothing for me to get better. Oh my God, no one's in charge. Like no one's going to give me the exact prescription. I mean, I had tried all of it, right?
The adults don't even know, right?
Yes. I always tell my clients, like, no one's in charge at the wheel. And so it shows up in a lot of ways. And again, we've been kind of ingrained that someone at the pulpit, right? Whether it's a priest, a doctor, a man, like any expert anymore, has all the answers versus there can be experts, but there's no all-knowing authority of like what your next steps are.
Yeah, it makes so much sense. I mean, it's like there's some internalized misogyny in there.
Yeah.
There's some, for sure, you know, Disney fantasy of the man saving you. There's some daddy issues in there that I never, you know, I just thought if I could capture and keep what I sometimes got from him, but not very often, but sometimes I got it enough to know what it would feel like to have the light shining on me. If I could capture and keep that, I would be safe, okay, chosen, fixed, et cetera.
Well, this brings up, a listener had a question that you had shared. You had done deep work around your anxious attachment for men and eating disorders. And she wanted to know if you could share what that deep work entails.
How long do you have?
Right.
This is why I'm writing an entire, this is my next book. It's not, okay. I mean, it's not a lot. The eating stuff is definitely in there, but that is the, like, if there is a, you know, the bottom of the well, the center of the whatever it is, that attachment stuff with men. And like I said earlier, the work that I did, so I'll touch on how the food played into that. I mean, it was all body stuff. Mm-hmm. It was, my body needs to be a certain way to attract men, to be sexual, to keep men, that is so intense. And I don't think I need to explain that to anybody, any woman that is alive right now, right? We live in that world, at least anybody who cares about the male gaze and probably people who don't. So food became the problem, right? If I could control food, well, my body became the problem, put it that way. And food was part of that. If I could just tame my body enough, shape it enough, like you said, control the appetites. Controlling the appetites was the problem. And food was the primary mechanism through which I could achieve that. Because I had the exercise part nailed down, like that was fine, but I just had to get enough control over food. And I had it sort of hit peak problem when I was late in high school, right around the time I was starting to like really desire more male attention. I was a late bloomer. I wasn't quite ready for it until then. And then I was ready for it. It wasn't coming to me. And I felt like my body was the problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would obsess. There's too much here, not enough there, all of that. And so I, for a brief period of time, about 2 years, I restricted enough to lose a lot of weight. And you know how that is. The rubber band gets tighter, 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 tighter. Then it eventually did snap, and I binged for like the next 10 years, and I couldn't get back to that. But in that time, I got more male attention than I ever had in my entire life. And that was like a drug. And I just wanted to get back to that part because I thought if I could get back to that part, I could get what I needed and what I wanted, which was this attention, not just attention, but like to be loved and to have a boyfriend. And I couldn't get it. It was like I had it and it slipped through my fingers. And then I lost it. And then I gained a bunch of weight in college and I sort of kept it on. And that just, it continued, my obsession with my body and with food, therefore, was the biggest monkey on my back. It was a 24-hour day, 7-day week, 365 days a year job. And it consumed me. And so that's, I guess, how it played. There's a direct line from if my body could be fixed, I could get the attention from men that I needed. Alcohol entered the picture in like a bigger way in my late 20s. I mean, it was always there. I would say that my addiction to alcohol sort of supplanted the disordered eating such that I was just eating less because my addiction was so bad. Like mm-hmm. That's a very common symptom of, you know, starting to get into the acute level of alcohol addiction. And I lost the weight and my anxiety got worse too, which helped me lose the weight. So I thought, oh, my food issues are over. I've tamed that. And no, it was just supplanted by my alcohol addiction. There was another part of the question. Oh, the work I did. Okay. So the work I did on love addiction, whatever we're going to call it, the attachment wounds, getting sober was absolutely necessary. Removing the alcohol, you know, physical sobriety, but also starting to do just the work that comes with getting sober, some just more self-awareness. I had always and have always been a seeker. So I was already very aware of a lot of the concepts of personal development, of self-help, dabbled in therapy. I was very aware of these things, but I didn't, like we are talking about, experience any of them. They were very intellectual until I got sober. And then I started to experience them and do that work. And what that looked like was really actually doing therapy, not just like dabbling and then running out the door, really doing therapy. I did the 12 steps, which was very helpful to me. I participated in recovery meetings, which is, there's a lot of healing that goes on there when you participate. And those were both AA meetings and then other kind of community meetings that informal. I wouldn't even call them community meetings. They were just being in relationship with other people who were healing in sobriety and having close friendships and starting to have healthy relationships with men, even if I wasn't dating them, just like starting to heal that, to start to trust men again, to start to be in relationship with men who didn't want me for my body or for sex, but they just adored me, right? That helped a lot. I did the most intense work that I did was around year 4 or 5 of sobriety, where I worked with a therapist who focused on love addiction and attachment trauma for about a year. Jody White, who I mention anytime I can because she was extremely helpful to me. She does have a one-on-one practice still. She lives in Austin, but I don't think she does one-on-one coaching anymore. She does more group facilitation, but she's absolutely worth looking up. And then I also got immersed in Kelly McDaniel's work on mother hunger. Mm-hmm. And that was very helpful too. And then, you know, I got into a relationship, a healthy relationship. And that's where it all sort of, the real practice of it began. So it was all those things. And that's a span of about 8 years there. It wasn't like a 6 month intensive where I like dug in and then everything was okay. And look, I still have flare ups. I still struggle a little bit. I just happen to be lucky enough to have chosen a partner and be in relationship with someone who can meet me where I am. And he has a secure enough attachment style, I think, that it works for me. He isn't the avoidant attachment style that I had always attracted, and which would be impossible for me, I think, to be healthy in a relationship if I was still, if I was trying to be in a relationship with someone like that.
Yeah. It strikes me though, that is it luck or is it preparation meets opportunity?
Both. I always want to say that it's luck because this is why, and I think this is really important. I don't like the idea, like if you take these steps, will get it. I hate that, especially around romantic relationships, because it's just, sure. I don't think that's true. There has to be an element of luck in there. And that applies to everything. Like, I know you feel the same way. Like, we are not in a meritocracy when it comes to really anything. So I always add that there's luck in there because it wasn't just that I did the work and it all paid off the way it should.
Yeah. And though I think, right, everything is complex. And I think it's because when I work on this with clients, right, when we have certain stories, it guides us, it opens us to a certain type of information. And often we keep doing the thing that makes the story true, right? So you were saying, yep. I got a lot of attention from men when I was thin. It's like, yeah, there are men out there that just want a certain, like, it's all about beauty, right?
I'm not here. Yeah, of course. We live in that world. That's true.
And there's a lot of men where that's not the marquee attraction, right? And so there is a part of like, when you really do the healing, I often think what you feel is attractive shifts, right? Yes. Like you said, he has more secure attachment than avoidant, which a lot of people think attraction is drama, right? So it's like a whole conversation on how are we defining attraction and what goes into attraction. But I do want to say there is that element of, as we expand upon our self-trust and what feels in alignment by bringing the emotional safety of like, what do I need? I need someone who's not just going to be here, you know, avoidant or about my looks. It's like, I need someone who adores me for me. It does open you up to different types of people. So there is
100%.
Yeah. So yeah, no, it doesn't mean it's all going to work out. And we
know as we change what we bring into our world absolutely changes. That's very real.
Yeah. And what I see you saying most deeply, right? It's like, I always think healing the obstacle is the path, is like you weren't seen and heard in when you were young. And by showing up in recovery spaces, having male friends, each time you're getting seen and heard, right? It's like, and it's not for just the fun stuff, right? It's like stuff. Oh, you're building capacity for actually receiving what you need, which is a whole other thing. I do want to give you credit because I do think that's important to recognize.
Thank you. Things. Yes, I agree. I worked my ass off for a lot of this. And Kelly McDaniel calls love addiction recovery or attachment trauma recovery like the PhD of recovery.
Yes.
Like, it is harder than anything else to do. And I totally agree. It's why I'm writing another book about it, because to me, it was like a second sobriety and almost a harder sobriety, because it's way in there. You know, it's where we are the most wounded. It hurts. It's embarrassing to me. I had to get over all those ideas about the cringe factor.
Yeah.
Thank you. And yes, that is also true. It wasn't a passive process.
A lot of integration. So, well, thank you for sharing that. Because I know that it's sometimes the deeper stuff, and I'm so glad you're writing a third book about it. So we'll have you back on for that. But again, to me, that just tracks with how food represents safety, right? It's like, if we don't have a solid sense of attachment safety, that can often be what we turn to. So the next thing you say is, and speaking of being seen and heard, what I really felt, and you said, it's unfair. This is your thing. This is your thing. And this struck me again, if I kind of do a callback to Dr. Becky, but I'm in the midst of raising a toddler right now and I'm trying to do more like conditional parenting where it's not every time he's upset. It's like, why are you upset? You have food, shelter, and water. You know, it's like, yeah, transitions are hard. I struggle with transitions, you know, but there's something that shifts in us. I think when someone says, like, it's unfair that this is your thing, then we can actually hear this is your thing. You know, we can surrender to that reality. And one of the things I really wanted to talk to you about, because I had this big aha reading your book, was you mentioned grief. You talk about the grief we have to go through when we give up the things that we use to cope. And I think that's true of alcohol and food. And mm-hmm. I also see this grief applied to the illusions that die when we actually address the emotional roots. Like, no one's coming to save you.
Yeah.
No one has all the answers. Being thin won't solve all your problems.
Yeah.
And you talk about grief also in losing the idea of things being simple, and they're way more complex. Like, you just described healing from attachment, you know, and it's, again, it's a practice, like you said. Mm-hmm. And I just love that you mentioned that, because I talked about this on my podcast interview with you. I can still remember where I realized losing more weight was not going to solve how difficult it is to build a business, right? It was not, wasn't like, oh, like getting lost in that fantasy. And so I really get this, but I hadn't really pinned it as grief, and you writing it, that was like, so like, yes, that's what it is.
Yeah.
So was there a different grief in not using alcohol and food, or thinking controlling your body was going to bring the love that you wanted, or was it the same? And I'm curious about that.
That's a great question. I've never thought about that. It's different. I know that it's different because I have never felt the grief around the food process that I did around alcohol, a drinking identity, all the things that I had yoked to being a drinker. I honestly, Ali, think I'm still in the process of letting go of the idea that a certain body will answer things in my life. It's way, 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 way less pronounced, and it really only flares up in times of stress. So I've talked about that with you, that in times of stress, I will go back to the food control. You know, there's got to be a diet, a plan, a this, a that, that I can engage in that will fix, well, what I think I want to fix is my food problems, quote unquote, or my body problems. And it's weird. It's like returning just to the home base or something, because it never lasts for long. I go down a road and I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? There's no answers here.
Love the honesty.
Yeah. So I have to think about this question, because it's really interesting. I think it's the difference with the food. Food is different. And we've talked about this, because you stop using it. Abstinence is a thing, and you're not going to die if you stop drinking, but food just is there. I think if you're saying like letting go of the grief of the fantasy around what drinking will give and what food will give, I'd say they're similar. Letting go of any fantasy that something is going to fix it. It's going to fill that hole. Whatever the hole is really hard. In that way, they're the same. The grief process with alcohol was so much more acute and intense for me that I can't really, like, I can't put those two together in my mind. But if I look at just sort of the baseline fantasy of what both of those stories provided throughout my life, having to let them go is similar. I think it's just food is an ongoing one, or body stuff is. I equate it much more to body things than food. I feel like with food, I'm pretty chill now. I don't stress about it. Eating isn't an anxiety producing thing for me anymore, but my body can be.
The difference is, again, from my lens, is that our bodies are often just this kind of, and I interviewed Sol Reynolds, who's a Jungian depth psychologist and nurse, all this, but she talked about the body is just a dumping ground for all the emotions, right? That like we don't want to feel, versus there's a difference. How we eat is indicating how we're relating to life. So there is a difference there, but they're interconnected, because we think food leads to the body, but they are separate things, but they both connect to, in my work, like when we're feeling at risk. So what you're saying is stress is like, there's risks in that stress, right? So it's like, how do I manage that? Gets dumped on the body. And there's other things besides, like you said, there's exercise, there's food, there's other things that go into the body, especially like you and I are in our 40s. There's aging. There's, So it's, I think there's other ways of stressing about the body. It's definitely different, especially because I'm thinking even like one of the, I survey people when they're done with Truce with Food, and like 85% of people are like, oh, I no longer believe I have to give up my favorite foods. 85% of people no longer believe that they have to isolate themselves from social situations. Right. And it's like, oh yeah, because I have learned to be moderate. But to your point, and in the way you define sobriety, you can't be moderate with alcohol. So it is different, but the fantasies of both, that's a separate grieving of an illusion, right?
Yes.
Actual thing.
Yes. Yeah. The grieving of the illusion. It's weird. The food thing is, it occupied so much space in my life for so long. And then it didn't, like I said, because alcohol, the addiction sort of just supplanted it.
Yeah.
And then that became the primary thing I had to deal with. I think just in the process of recovery, I had to let go of a lot of food stuff because I just couldn't do both at the same time. It's like it just forced me to let go of it. And I also think there's just something, I know this isn't true for everybody because I just know it's not. Food comes up in my recovery community all the time. But for me, there was something about getting older and realizing I didn't want to live my life consumed with thoughts of food in my body constantly anymore. It was like, I just don't want to. And I will be honest too, I am thin enough and conventionally like attractive enough that I think I get that privilege.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up because I had my own kind of reckoning postpartum. I also went through menopause at the same time of being postpartum. And I went to the doctor like a year after because I had plantar fasciitis. And I found out I was like,
oh, that's the worst.
Yeah. But I found out I was 30 pounds above my pre-pregnancy weight. And it was like, for 15 years, I had not worried about my weight. I was like, I have a Truce with Food, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, but now that I feel, and I'm only 5'4" and a half. So that, like 30 pounds is a lot. And I wasn't sleeping. I mean, there was a lot going on, but I was like, oh, this is like a different experience when you really actually, because I was never even thin enough. Like I was just average, but I've tipped that point of privilege in a way, you know? So at least in my mind, but I was glad that I like, it didn't affect me the same way. And I was able to handle it in a much healthier way. But I get what you're saying. When a lot of people who are like, don't worry about your weight. It's, there is a certain amount of privilege that's there, I guess. So I'm glad
totally.
You
brought
that up. Yeah.
Maintenance pace has taught me a lot about that.
Yeah, I know you love that. Yeah, that's, they have some great episodes. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask, I love when you said this because I feel the same way about our battle with food, but you said, you talked about on page 99 of your book, you go, I'm not exactly sure when I went from being unable to accept this as my thing to being stubbornly proud of it. But somewhere along the way, I realized that inside this experience was my big adventure. Mm-hmm. It was the portal to my becoming. It's what I mean when I say our things are invitation. And this line, like just, I was like, she nailed it again. This is your invitation to the possibility of everything you could become. It doesn't count you out. It counts you in. Mm-hmm. And I just love this because again, to me, this is the spiritual. Are you being willing to be led to understand you're stronger than you think? You're more whole than you think? This is what I found in my own food and body battle. And it's why I created Truce with Food, how I did. I know you've talked about food and body and kind of the body stuff still working through, but do you think there was an invitation in your body battle? And have you, well, first I want to, have you had pushback of people saying sobriety is an invitation?
Oh yeah, of course. No one wants to hear that because if you're not there yet, that just sounds like Hallmark trite bullshit.
Yeah, that's true.
Toxic positivity.
Such a good point. I never thought of it.
You don't think about that because you know that it's true.
Yeah, but you're right. Oh my God, you're right.
Oh yeah. So I've had pushback on that. I mean, people hate We Are the Luckiest too. Many people have told me how much they hated the title of that book until they read it and they realize like, oh, she's not coming from this toxic positivity place at all. She's coming, like she went through a whole journey to get here. So yeah, I've had pushback from that. I hear it all the time. I would have pushed back on that. I remember going into meetings and people would say, I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I was like, fuck you. You are not.
Well, yeah, I even think like in my groups, like I guess I'm admitting it publicly now, but in my groups, I'm like, I wouldn't have said this at the beginning, but I'm grateful that I had my struggle with food because it taught me how to really learn about my body. It taught me what I'm capable of. I feel better able to navigate my health, even my pregnancy, menopause, all these things. But I wouldn't have said that. And I don't feel like, I even feel like it's surprising to me that you got pushback, but once you explain it, yeah. But I feel like even to say your body battle is an invitation is like, oh, you're just stuck in the patriarchy. Like, I feel like it's less PC to probably say that about.
I think that you're totally right about that. That was even like coming up in my mind as you were asking the question. Look, anything that breaks you of the ways that you, how do I want to say this? It's the hero's journey. It's the heroine's journey. It's true for a reason, because in that disillusionment phase is what we have to go through. You know, we survive life based on certain ideas, axioms, paradigms, thought processes, coping mechanisms. And then most people reach a place where those things don't work. They're backs against the wall and they're brought into some sort of circumstance that is so painful and where none of those mechanisms that worked before, where everything they thought was true is no longer true. And it breaks you in every way, emotionally, spiritually, mentally, physically, and it feels like death because it is a death. And that is the good news. Those things that got you this far were not going to carry you into the next phase. At the time, like I said, it feels like a death because it is a death. And you can't bypass the pain of it, the grief of it, the disillusionment. You cannot bypass that part. That is part of the journey. The reason it's an invitation is because you don't have to accept it. Some people, I would say most people, don't accept it. They don't accept the invitation because it's too hard. It's too scary. It's much easier. At least that's what we tell ourselves, to stay the same. Like, this shit is hard, right? It's the dark night of the soul. And so anything, whether it's your body or alcohol addiction or any other addiction or grief or divorce or any of the things that serve as an invitation, which I call things in my books, they are always invitations. My body stuff is and has been an invitation, yes. To deny that it's an invitation, I get why people feel that way. They should feel that way. That's part of the disillusionment.
Yeah, it makes Wendell Berry, who's like a poet, he has this, I'm going to butcher it, but it's like, when you no longer know which way to go, basically, that's when the real work begins.
Yeah. It's like, that's the part about being led. And, you know, that quote, that little phrase comes from Richard Rohr when he's talking about the falling upward. He has a book called Falling Upward. And he also terms it the second half of life. Jung called it the afternoon of life. There have been many spiritual teachers, psychologists, philosophers throughout time who recognize that there are distinct phases in our life, at least two. And in the first one, we lead in whatever ways we can. And we think that, you know, we think that the individual is all powerful. We basically buy into the entire American dream.
Yeah.
Right. It's not just American though. It's a spiritual sort of idea or axiom as well, that the ego has to be built up and it's necessary. This isn't bad. That part of our life isn't bad. It's necessary. We have to build our ego up to a certain point. We have to conquer. We have to go through all of these things. It's part of our maturation. And then the afternoon of life is where we are led.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, but it also requires like dying to that younger, earlier version has to die into itself.
Yeah.
No one wants to go through that.
No. Well, and it also makes me think about, in your book, you talk about capable, right? And it comes up a lot in the work with my clients too. They want to look capable, and it's part of why their safety isn't what it is and they turn to food. But you talk about how bringing up how capable, how you originally were defining it as like handling shit and powering through, but how that backfires with our things. It makes me think in the second half of life, if you don't aren't willing to be led, it feels like you're incapable in a way. It's like,
yeah, well, it's very counterintuitive.
Yeah.
It's like the whole idea of the first half of life is that I can do it.
Yeah. But now I feel like it's like, okay, how do I create with what wants to happen? That's at least where I'm at. And like,
yeah. Well, that's why I say the ultimate act of responsibility in the responsibility chapter is asking for help.
Yes.
And it's a very confusing idea.
Well, and I love you wrote in your Substack, everyone check out Laura's Substack, but it makes me think of the soft versus strength binary. That isn't really true, right? It's not a binary. It's like they contain each other. They're paradoxes.
They contain each other. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Well, this brings up another question that someone wrote in about kind of self-help and this invitation. She wrote, I gave up drinking and transferred to restricting binging with food. Mm. While I'm always trying to move forward, at what point do we work on accepting ourselves instead of constantly trying to heal something? Obviously, the drinking needs to go, but why do I feel so addicted to self-improvement? I'm tired of trying to better and never accepting myself as it is. So where do you draw the line between the invitation and continual self-improvement?
Wow, that's a great question. And it's a very real thing because we live in a culture of productivity worship and self-optimization as the answer to all things. And
yeah,
you know,
I just get tired hearing the word optimize. I'm like, I done.
Can I not?
What's peace out.
Yeah. Peace out. I'm out of the optimization. The word that comes to mind in there is grace. The line is where you have grace for yourself. First of all, before even that, we're just in a process. Like there is no end point ever. So yeah. Letting go of that is a huge deal. It's not if I get to this place with this, I will achieve this. Whether it's your success, your body, your food, stopping drinking, those are when we view them as outside things and we believe they are outside things, they will never, and we approach them as though they are just habits and things that we have to tame and fix and project manage our way into bettering. Even if you checked all those boxes, not only are they not going to go away because a new thing crops up because it's never about the outside thing, but you're never going to feel the way you think you're going to feel when you get there. So it's always the inside job. And what she's talking about is the inside job. We have to get to a place where we say, I'm not okay. And that's okay.
Yeah. That was beautiful. Yeah.
This isn't a failure. It's just, there's patterns that are dysfunctional in my life. There's patterns that are causing unnecessary chaos and pain. And I want to approach them with self-compassion and love, not with punitive self-punishment. And I think that's the difference between what she's saying and the question. I think that's the answer of the question she's asking, because there's always more.
Yeah. Because my answer to this was, I think of nature, and I think nature's always evolving into higher levels of complexity, right? Like the vertebrae, the fish that had no vertebrae that kind of kicked this all off or whatever. I mean, I'm not an evolutionist, but I believe in evolution. I have to say that.
You're like, hold on.
I just meant like how we've evolved as a species. And that's part of humans' gifts is I feel like nature has this drive to grow into ever increasing levels of complexity. Like you even being able to explain healing from your attachment wound, right? It's like, well, it was this and it was this, but I also had to go through alcohol, right? Like there's more complexity than steps there, right?
Yeah.
But I think about how nature also rests, you know, like it again, in capitalism and optimism and productivity, capitalism, white supremacy, patriarchy, it takes these moderate impulses and puts them on steroids, I feel like.
Yes.
Or human instincts. And so to me, it's like there needs to be rest and integration, but also nature is just here to experience itself. And I think that's what you're saying is it's like an inside job. Like, what is the experience of this versus thinking I'm getting somewhere? Because I've found with my clients and myself, and I think you communicate this in the book of when you're really invested in like, you have to face it and RSVP and like really show up, it's an embodiment. And that embodiment shifts things. Again, we skip that step. It's like, get me to the steps versus feeling our way through it. Now I'm kind of going off on a tangent, but I think we lose our instincts of, okay, what is life calling and how do I go and grow in that way towards more complexity and compassion for myself, the world, what's calling me versus I got to just go and it's going to be more simple and I'm going to find relief. That's kind of the promise. I don't
yeah, know. No, I hear you. We're both like sort of struggling to articulate an answer to this because it's, look, there are real things that we can do to decrease the chaos in our lives, to improve our relationships and our levels of peace. That's true. But I don't think we ever get there by approaching ourselves as an endless self-improvement project.
Yeah.
It's like, why are you doing these things? That's, I think, where the difference is. Why are you doing it?
Yeah. I loved in your book how you, because I'm not as familiar with alcohol or anything, because I always was like, I'm going to use my calories for food. I mean, that's the only reason I didn't really become into alcohol or anything. But you were talking about in the beginning of your book, there's not a lot of compassion in the general mainstream for alcohol, or I would say even for people who use food, or it's like, just get it together. What's your problem? Right.
No, right.
That's a relational approach of like, fix yourself, fix yourself, fix yourself.
Yep.
Versus, and you just do such a great job of breaking down to me too, just how toxic it is that we normalize alcohol and all this stuff. And it's like, wait, you're not the problem. Like, how can you understand this is a coping, or I think of it as protective strategies. And there's just a different energy when you bring, there's more patience, there's more compassion versus I'm kind of trying to stay three steps ahead of my pain, I guess is
yeah, no, you're, that's so exactly it.
So I've had all these questions to ask you, but this is the direction the interview went. So I want to ask you one last one. So in your book, you talk about when you're getting sober, or I even think about when we stop fighting food, we have a list of knowns. We know what it's going to be like. You talk about you're going to have less self-hatred. You could keep a job. You can sleep better, paying bills on time. And then you ask about the unknowns. What are all the ways your life could change that you've dreamed to dare about?
That you don't even know about. You just can't fathom them because they're not even in your consciousness. Like, you know the things, you know the knowns that, okay, I'll probably feel better. My relationships won't be terrible. You know,
yes.
I might be more at peace in my body or whatever. We don't. So those are the knowns, just to clarify that point.
I love that you said, yeah. But you said, this is where the real juice of sobriety is for me. There's the deeper calling of your soul, the unique potential of your life that only you can fulfill. It's what I call the bigger yes. And again, to me, this is, are you tapping into where life wants you to be led, which to me is God, source. Mm-hmm. And so a listener asked, eating disorders and alcohol use disorders seem to be commonly shared maladaptive coping mechanisms of sensitive, empathetic, perceptive people. I'm wondering what you see on the flip side of this. Once a person has begun to heal, what do you find those in recovery excel with? And push off from here, where do you suggest people take their energy and push off to?
Okay. So it's a little bit different for everybody, but I know that the common denominator is taking all that energy that was being used to engage in disordered eating, in drinking, you know, the abusive relationship and all that they said, you know, the maladaptive coping mechanisms, stopping using it for protection and starting to use it for growth. Mm-hmm. Or if you look at it as using it for expansiveness versus like contraction, or using it for potential versus just safety all the time.
Yes.
So it's a very closed system versus an open system. Where that leads is like very different for each person. And I don't mean, a lot of people confuse when I say the bigger yes to mean some outside measure of success, right? Like a bigger job and the relationship and engaged and married and having kids or like this. And sometimes those things do happen, but that's not what I'm talking about with a bigger yes. It's not some outside measure. It's knowing, it's this knowing that you're in alignment.
Yes. I always use that word alignment because it brings context and nuance versus.
Well, because, and you also know it when you feel it and you know it when you don't feel it. Are the things that I think about and say and feel and do more or less the same? Or are they vastly different?
And I love that you talked about that energy being expansive. It made me think, I just finished up Dr. Gabor Mate's The Myth of Normal.
Oh, I haven't tried it yet. I know I will, and I know I want to. It's just, I know it's going to be so heavy.
but you're also going to love it because it's kind of what you're talking about, like a lot of the things that people might try to shame you for, right? Which you're trying to protect yourself are actually your superpower. Like our culture is not normal. But he talked about how Greta Thunberg, and I didn't know this, but he said we all know who she is, right? She's like this climate activist. But he said that she had divulged in an interview that before getting involved with the climate campaign, she said she had no friends, no energy, and didn't speak to anyone. I just sat at home with an eating disorder. Oh. Yeah. And she has autism and she views it as her superpower. Yeah. And so I think about in a culture that, you know, doesn't honor neurodivergence or people who are like the canaries in the coal mine who can see like what is normal. Is crazy. I mean, that's the whole premise of Trust with Food. Like what we've normalized is crazy.
Yes. Right. Same with alcohol. Like a lot of what I talk about with alcohol culture.
Yes. And it makes me think, again, I'm just going to use my lens, but I help people figure out what foods work best for them through a nervous system. Like, are you parasympathetic dominant, sympathetic dominant, or balanced? But what this listener is describing, and I think it describes you too, because I think you do better with like a paleo diet, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So it makes me think of people who are parasympathetic dominant. And again, we have both, but they tend to do better with paleo. They're not fond of cardio, but if you're trying to lose weight and told thinness is the answer, it's like everyone thinks they need to do cardio. They tend towards like depression and mood stuff. Mm-hmm. There's less wiggle room for what we can put in our body. We're more sensitive to perfumes, scents, the air, you know? So it's like, oh my God, we end up thinking that we're too sensitive versus it's like, why do we have all these air fresheners everywhere? Like they're toxic, you know?
Yes.
And then intellectually and emotionally, parasympathetic people tend to be creative, sensitive, they're perceptive, they're connected to the universal or abstract versus being inherently type A and rooted in the material world, right? And America is definitely rooted in the material world. Mm-hmm. And they tend to be more slow starters. So their natural cadence is to go more slow, right? And I think about creativity requires slowness. If you are that way, that creative, perceptive, sensitive, the culture is just all over, not aligned with your system. And so you're like taught to turn on yourself all the time. So I love that you said, is it expansive versus contractive? Like really be in alignment with who you are so that you can expand into the next step and stuff like that. I don't know.
Yeah, that's all good and true and reflective of what I mean.
Yeah. And I love that you said it's not the outward, it is that inward. I think of it as like self-actualization almost. Like there's that
it is.
Of yes, that's the bigger yes of like experiencing who I'm really meant to grow into and evolve as.
So. Well, and there's an external reality that comes with that often. I mean, I see people, for example, stop working in jobs they hate.
Yeah.
And finally follow because they have the energy and the presence of mind and the everything else to actually follow through with what they want to do or what they've thought about doing, go off and start incredible, amazing jobs, communities, initiatives that contribute to the whole in these profound ways when they get sober. I see people have finally leave their loveless marriages and do that when they just couldn't before because the entropy was so profound, you know, they can't break out of the system. I see people, you know, one of the things I talk about is like one of the biggest reasons for healing and for forgiving oneself as part of that healing, which is something we're very reticent to do, is because you have to be the change that you want in the world. And especially in family systems, that's where I see it happen most often. Mm-hmm. You have to be the one to break the pattern if you want the pattern to be broken. I saw, for example, with my drinking, I had a very hard time, as many women do and everyone, but especially women, if they drink, or this probably applies to body issues too, because we see our kids mirroring our body issues or anxieties, right? Around food and body.
Yeah.
And we hate that it's happening. And we know that we are playing a part in it, but yet we can't, for whatever reason, stop beating the shit out of ourselves for what we're doing. And change, I know change never comes from a place of self-beating. It just doesn't work. It will never work. It has to come from this place of curiosity and self-compassion. But we don't believe that that will work. We just don't believe that it will. And one of the reasons, if you turn down every other reason, the reason that you have to do and be what you want to change, that's the reason. So if you don't want your kids to replicate what you have experienced, forgive yourself for it, right? I don't know how I got there from where we started, but that's the bigger yes part. That's what it is, you're not running away from things anymore. You're actually chasing something bigger. It's not about the no anymore. It's about the yes.
I love that. And I think it's what you're also saying is it's connected to something bigger, whether it's breaking a family system, whether it's you with your writing.
Yeah,
whether
being of service in the world, right?
Yes.
Instead of just spiraling in this circle of this very, I don't want to say selfish, but this sort of self-beating and very private. You can't be of much service to the world or the people around you when you hate yourself.
Yeah. Well, and we have enough of that direction.
Yeah, I think we're all set on that.
Yeah, yeah. Like we have enough of that, enough systems rooted in hatred of really, no one really benefits from them except like a very small margin. So we have enough of that. And it's so powerful that, yeah, it's like we have to be the change. And Gandhi, everyone quotes him. And I read this New York Times article about how like the full quote was change yourself so then you can go out. And this is not the no one quote me verbatim, but the sentiment was be the change. So then you can go out and constructively change society because you've had that lived experience and you're breaking the conditioning.
Yep.
Anyone can change things, but if you want to like change them for more wholeness, you have to bring that from yourself first.
Yes. Right.
I want to end with this. I think this quote that you wrote that just, I actually shared it with someone in my group. I'm like, cause she was saying how she betrayed herself to go to a certain type of schooling that would look like traditional success, but it really isn't success for her. And she's learning from that. And I said, well, I'm going to share this line from Laura's book. And I love it. And I kind of want to end on it. It says, if we didn't know the pain of being lost, how would we ever appreciate the miracle of coming home? Mm-hmm. And I think that bigger yes, that speaks to the bigger yes too.
Yeah. And everything we've talked about, like you just, you have to go through that dark part. That is the invitation.
Thank you so much, Laura. Do you have anything you want to say that I didn't get to?
No, I just hope you heavily edit this because I was so all over the place.
I thought it was great. You're working some stuff out. I think people can appreciate that it's in process.
Yeah. I don't talk about food often. So it's just a little, I have to like figure it out while I'm talking type of thing.
Well, and I appreciate you willing to talk about it because a lot of people actually go into a void mode around it versus tackling it. And it's like, it may look more noble to avoid it, but it doesn't solve anything. So I appreciate that you're willing to talk about it.
Yeah, I totally am. It's not that I feel weird about talking about it. It's just I haven't examined it quite as much. So that's why I appreciate your work.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, health rebels and visionary storytellers, for tuning in today. If you know someone who would benefit from this episode, please share it with them. And remember, we have transcripts of our episodes at allyshapiro.com/podcast for your non-audio friends and family. And if you can, I'd love it if you can leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps more people find the show. And both actions, reviewing and sharing with others, helps us change the cultural narrative around food, weight, and our bodies. Thanks for engaging in a different kind of conversation. And remember, always, your body truths are unique, discoverable, profound, and liberating.